On the morning of April 16, 2007, Colin Goddard was exactly where he was supposed to be in French class at Virginia Tech. And although he was shot, he says it was only a matter of luck that he wasn't one of the 32 students, including the shooter, who were killed that day. Since then, he's become an advocate for stricter gun control, and he's the subject of a new documentary called Living for 32, directed by Kevin Breslin. I'm very pleased that it brings Colin Goddard to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So what happened to you on that day of the shooting? How many times were you shot?
I shot four times in total during that 10-minute period.
And why did you survive when others died?
I still don't really know
the
answer to that
question.
Did you
duck under the seat or something?
Yeah, I ducked under the floor. There was nowhere to go. He was coming in and out of the only door. The windows weren't an option. So, you know, I did nothing else different than the other students around me. And yet, when it was all said and done with, I was still alive.
Was he just spraying bullets?
Yeah. Apparently, he kind of stayed at the front of the class the first time and shot from there to pin everyone down, and then more methodically came down the rows the next times he visited.
How does this compare to other school shootings in the country? The Columbine, for example.
Columbine. Well, we actually learned a lot from Columbine, or law enforcement did. That in that instance, they waited until they had a perimeter set up, and then it was actually hours later that they actually entered the school, and they learned that they can't do that in these active shooter situations. So from there, small groups from Virginia Tech, small groups of police officers, two or three of them joined up and then went in directly. They didn't wait around to form a perimeter. They tried to get in. Unfortunately, Cho had chained the main doors of the building closed from the inside, so they couldn't get in. They had to find a maintenance door that they ultimately found and blew the lock off that and went inside.
So he really had prepared for this. Chaining the door locked is way beyond just simply coming in and expressing a lot of rage.
Right. It was very premeditated, and that's also a reason why it also allowed for a lot of opportunities to intervene during that point. With his mental health as well, he was trying to actively seek help with the university system and was told to get outpatient therapy, and then was never really followed up on. And in the meantime, he went and killed 32 people and himself.
Well, you were shot four times. That creates a real trauma for the body, doesn't it?
I've been fortunate enough that none of the injuries I sustained were really life-threatening, didn't hit any major organs or nerve centers. The one that came in my left side did break the femur in my left leg, which I had to put a titanium rod in there. That'll be with me. And three of the four bullets that entered never left, so I have those with me as well.
They never left because those bullets where people cut
hollow
the heads?
Hollow point tips, yes.
The sorts of things that cops like, but many people are concerned about because it means you don't get – it doesn't go cleanly through your body.
Correct. It doesn't pass from one target possibly into another. That's what cops are concerned about. But it's also very lethal. It's more lethal to that first target that it hits.
And they can't cut them out?
Since they're all in pieces, they can. But the doctors told me that because they're in kind of sensitive areas around my hips, that only in the case of pain or discomfort that they'll remove them. I actually had a surgery about 3 months ago to get some of them out that had surfaced and were starting to hurt.
Well, you look fine. So in effect, you've had almost a complete recovery.
Right. Physically, yeah. I mean, I can return to the gym and play the sports again and run around again, which is great. And I think the physical recovery is directly related to the mental recovery.
And what about that? Going back to Virginia Tech, could you just do that?
A lot of people were surprised that I did. I had 1 year to finish. And in my mind, there was no other place to go. I had to go back. I didn't want that place to remain a negative emotion, a negative memory for me. I wanted to go back there and kind of get back and conquer it. And I ended up with a great last year.
How did the shooter, Cho Seung-hui, acquire the guns that he used that day?
He purchased one from a store around in the local area and then one from the internet that was transferred to a store. We picked it up. He did them both legally through federally licensed dealers that conducted background checks. But a simple fact that his mental adjudication from the court that deemed him a danger to himself was not sent to the background check system. So when he took those background checks, he passed because his record wasn't there and they never found it.
In the film, you go to some gun shows. Can you describe what those shows are like and why you went to them?
Shows are big events on the weekend that dealers and private sellers attend and set up shop and are able to sell their guns to a large client base that draws attention from advertisements in the media and on the radio and billboards. And the reason I became aware of these is because of the Columbine High School shooting In that instance, three of the four guns used in that shooting were purchased from private sellers at gun shows with no background checks. You know, Cho didn't buy his guns at a gun show. I understand that. But it's one of the easiest places to go to get one if you don't want a background check.
Was it easy for him to purchase them in Virginia, which does not have the strictest gun control laws in the world?
Right. Well, he actually went through a fairly legitimate process to do it, you know. And actually, Virginia has a one handgun a month law, and he waited 30 days to buy the second pistol that he bought. So he followed the law to the T in that sense. But, you know, other people haven't before.
As you say, you can go to a gun show, and there's this gun show loophole, isn't there?
Yeah, that's the thing. There are two sellers, two different types of sellers selling the same weapons to the same people at the same venue. Yet one group has to run background checks, the other one doesn't. What we're proposing in the film and what I learned is, you know, why is that the case? You know, we need to make it more difficult for dangerous people to obtain these weapons. And one simple thing we can do is simply run a check. If you're a law-abiding citizen, you'll pass that background check anytime. This is not an incentive, or this is not an initiative to disarm people. I just simply want that responsible action is taken, so only the law-abiding citizens are the ones that walk out of those things with guns.
My guest is Colin Goddard, who was shot four times on April 16, 2007 at Virginia Tech. He is also the star, if you can call the person who's at the center of a documentary, the subject of a documentary that is called Living for 32. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So you are not opposed to people owning guns. But a part of the problem, as you describe it, is that the NRA pushes against any kinds of controls. Why do you think they do that? After all, if people can own guns under responsible conditions, wouldn't that be in the best interest of the NRA?
Right. I agree. I think we need to make a distinction between the NRA top brass and their membership. There was a recent poll by Frank Luntz this year where it's found that the majority of NRA members actually support an idea like closing the gun show loophole. We are totally for responsible gun ownership, and I know many people personally who are responsible with the firearms they own. I've been hunting with them. I've been to the range with them. It's not an issue. But then there are those who act irresponsibly, who sell it to people who they had no idea who they are. And is that a good, safe public policy? I don't think so.
Has Virginia Tech taken any action towards stricter gun control on campus since the incident?
No, they have maintained their stance that they would not allow students to carry concealed weapons on a campus.
Did your attitudes about gun control change at all as a result of this?
Absolutely. I mean, I had no idea what the laws were and what they weren't. I couldn't imagine that gun violence would be something that came and affect my life, touch me in the United States. I've grown up overseas most of my life in some dangerous countries. And, you know, when I got to the college in the U.S., people thought I was in the safe place, but I was actually in the most dangerous situation ever.
Some victims of gun violence become strong proponents of gun rights as a result because they see them as the best way to defend themselves. What do you say to people who claim that having guns on campuses keeps students safer?
I'd say that, you know, they're looking at the situation at the last possible second, a very narrow view that, you know, someone's about to come shoot you. Do you want a gun or not? When you frame it like that, you know, it's simple with the answers, of course. But you have to take a step back and realize that there are things that lead up to where you can intervene and make that situation not ever happen in the first place.
Well, I was just wondering about what would happen if this guy came in and then somebody pulled out a gun and started shooting at him. Wouldn't even more people have been hit, even just because you're having a wild shootout?
Who knows? You know, there are so many things that can happen there. It was the craziest day of my life with one person walking around with guns. I couldn't imagine that day with multiple people. It changes the dynamic of law enforcement's response to such a situation because currently they look for the person with the gun. This would change that, and it wouldn't be one student among many who have guns. It would be it would be one among many as opposed to one by themselves.
So you say people could own guns privately, but they should be kept off college campuses? How do you do that?
It's not the first step we should be taking. Just to allow the good students to shoot it out with the bad is not the way we deal with these problems. These are school policy issues. These are mental health issues and gun policy issues. We can do a whole lot more that we're not doing before we ever have to take this step. You know, that we have systems in place that are used to prevent this. And when they fail, it doesn't mean scrap the system. It means make it better.
Well, you got involved with the Brady campaign. James Brady became a strong proponent of gun control only after he was shot.
I believe that's true.
He was part of the Reagan administration. And then after he was shot, his idea was strict gun control on a national level. That is not likely to happen, not with recent Supreme Court decisions.
Well, I mean, the Brady bill that passed in 93, before then, when people went to go buy guns, they were required to fill out a form that said, you know, do you have a felony record? Do you have a history of mental illness? Check yes or no. It was on that person who was buying. So they checked no, 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 no. The seller would look, no, 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 no. Okay, here's your gun. They never checked to see if that person was actually telling the truth. It was called lie to buy. So with the Brady bill, his initiative was that, hey, we need to actually check to see if these people are telling the truth because not everybody does, especially those with bad intentions. So since then, actually, since that Brady bill passed in 1993, we've stopped 1.9 million transactions from happening from dangerous people.
On the other hand, haven't any number of states passed legislation that enables people to carry guns into places that they might not have in the past?
Yeah, currently under Obama's administration, that we have now can carry guns into national parks and guns onto Amtrak trains.
Was that a decision of the Obama administration?
No, it was actually added onto non-germane bills, last-minute things by the NRA, tactics, you know, strategies on the Hill to get it attached to credit card reform, you know, things that need to be done, and they understood that, so that's why they knew that it, you know, a line amendment like this would go forth.
When did you first realize that you want to become personally involved in advocating for changes in the way we deal with guns?
It was when I witnessed the first shooting unfold on the news. When, as many people witnessed the shooting at Virginia Tech happen on the news and from their televisions, it was the shooting in Binghamton, New York, actually, that I saw that, you know, I was sitting there watching the body count rise and watching everything unfold, and I realized, you know, there's a whole another families now getting a phone call, trying to get to the hospital. You know, nothing is done. This is still going on. I have to do something about this.
How long after you were shot did that happen?
I mean, it took a while. It took about a year, 2 years.
So before then, you just simply were dealing with the trauma of your experience.
I was trying to get back to a, you know, a normal level. I had 1 year of college to finish. Had to, you know, begin my young professional career. But my father became very involved right off the bat. Anytime something crazy like this happens to you and your family, you want to know why and how did this happen. So he started looking into the reasons, you know, the mental health, the school policies, and the gun policies. And he started telling me these things over the phone and at dinner. And finally, it all kind of all came to place when I was like, you know, this is some crazy stuff. People need to know that, you know, students want to bring their guns to class now. People need to know that, you know, there is no head of the ATF, and the ATF is getting their hands tied behind their back when they're the only enforcement mechanism there. When you have the NRA saying we don't need any more new law, we don't need any new laws, we need to enforce those that we have, they're also saying that with one hand, while the other hand also trying to undermine the laws that are already there.
We don't have any head of the ATF because Congress is resisting voting on that. Hasn't the president nominated somebody?
Recently, yes. First time he'd done that in a while. And the NRA does not support him. We think he's a great guy. And we hope that he does get confirmed and becomes the ATF because they need someone in this time, especially with the violence going on in Mexico.
So what is your position on all of this, that it's just a matter of enforcing the existing regulations or do we need new regulations?
No, there is the commonly accepted law that those who are dangerous, those who would do us harm should not have easy access to guns. I mean, it's quite simple. Allow, you know, requiring more background checks done on a broader scale only enables those who are going to be law-abiding to get guns. It's not a disarmament of American people. If you are a law-abiding citizen, you'll pass that background check every time. So I don't see how it disarms people. How can you require a background check that only prohibits dangerous people? And if you're not one of those, how do you, you know, you don't fall into that category. You will not be prohibited. I don't understand their argument.
My guest is Colin Goddard, a survivor of the Virginia Tech shooting, and the subject of a new film by Kevin Breslin called Living for 32. He's also campaigning for gun control with the Brady campaign. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We'll be right back after this. We're back with Colin Goddard, who was in his French class at Virginia Tech when Cho Seung-hui suddenly started shooting at students and killed 32, including himself. He is the subject of a new film called Living for 32, a documentary by Kevin Breslin. He's also now campaigning for, as part of the Brady campaign. Would banning guns from college campuses be a violation of the Second Amendment?
I don't believe so, as I understand it. And as I believe I understand Justice Scalia's remarks, that the Second Amendment is not a guns are allowed everywhere, anywhere, all the time. There are certain places where they shouldn't be allowed. Government buildings, for example, schools, churches. You know, it's up to the. It's ultimately, I leave it up to the decision of the university and what they choose to do.
Although people can take guns to churches and schools and supermarkets and movie theaters and wherever they want. In most states, not all states, although the courts, including Justice Scalia, have cut back on the rights of cities, especially municipalities, to limit the gun ownership. So are we moving in the right direction, do you think?
I think we are making advances. You know, there's a give and a take here. I think there's reasonable things we can meet at in the middle if there's only, you know, an effort to compromise and understand, you know, that there are things we can do to respect the Second Amendment rights of individuals while also making it harder for those dangerous people to obtain weapons and do bad things with them.
Although there's always been a debate over just what the Second Amendment means. Some people say that it definitely has something to do with a militia, which has nothing to do with whether I carry a gun into a supermarket or not. And then there's the other side that says, well, that says that, in effect, we can have guns anywhere.
Right. Well, that, you know, there are books and books written on the interpretation.
Well, you must have a position on that.
I would say that the Second Amendment is the only amendment in the Bill of Rights that has the word regulated in it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something right there.
So how did you get involved in the film?
It was actually with the Brady campaign. As I came on board, they had me speak in an event to tell my story of what happened and how I got involved with the Brady campaign. And there was a woman sitting in the back, whose name was Maria Cole, who was on the board, who approached me after the little event was over and said, "That was an amazing story. I'd love to get this on tape." So we met one time just to film a quick 5-minute PSA with Kevin Breslin, who was a good friend of hers. And when the cameras were turned off, we kind of just continued talking all together, and they realized there was a little more to this story. And they kind of developed, and it just kind of grew as it went very naturally, and it got to this 40-minute piece now.
Would you be interested in talking to some of our listeners? Because this, anytime we talk about guns and gun control, it's like opening up a hornet's nest. In New York, the general sentiment is for more gun control, but we have a fair number of people who complain that there's some kind of an anti-gun bias, especially on public radio.
Right. Well, in New York, they have some of the strictest gun laws in the country already.
And the mayor of New York would like to see more enforced. He doesn't like the idea that people can buy a gun in Georgia, come here, and sell it to somebody on the streets.
Exactly. The majority of the guns used in crimes in the state don't come from this state. And while one state can have very strict laws, if its neighboring state does not, you know, the flow is obvious of where it's going to be. So until we have some broad national legislation that covers all the holes, we'll still have problems like this.
We invite our listeners to give us a call here at 646-829-3985, or you can leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. The film is not just about your activism, but also about recovering from a trauma. We talked earlier about the physical aspects of it. What about the psychological aspects of it?
Well, you know, like I said, I had to return to the classroom setting, which was pretty intense to begin with. And you know, any loud noise you heard, any student coming in late would, you know, stop your heartbeat. But ultimately, you got comfortable with it again. And I got to participate in a few group therapy sessions with the survivors in my class, which I thought was very beneficial. You know, while the other survivors, we were all very close to each other that day physically, we all have very different recounts of the story and very different perspectives and things that we remember. So I learned a lot from hearing from the others. But I'd say that, you know, my friends from high school from before this event still think I'm the same guy I was before. Now I've just have my eyes open a little bit more to what goes on in this country and what doesn't, for that matter.
Well, the title of the film is Living for 32. Do you feel that that's what you're doing? You're living for the 32 who died? Which also includes the shooter, doesn't it?
That's 33 with the shooter, actually. And yeah, I wanted to honor them and remember them with the film and do something good after something so bad happened and bring good from it that will affect more people. It's not only for the 32 people who were killed that day. It's for the 32 Americans who are killed every single day in this country with guns. So that's a Virginia Tech that happens every single day, but it's just somehow accepted in this country as well. That's the way things are.
And you mentioned earlier gun violence in Mexico, because the Mexican government is concerned that people get guns in the United States and smuggle them into Mexico. We always talk about smuggling the other way, but guns are being smuggled into Mexico.
Yeah, that's a fact. That's not, you know, that is what's happening. It's very easy for them to come in here and buy these guns in bulk. That's why the ATF is trying to figure out now who's buying these bulk sales of assault rifles to try to figure out, you know, traffickers and who's involved with that business. So it's you know, it's not a debate whether it's happening or not. It's definitely happening.
Again, our number here is 646-829-3985. Amy left a question on our show page. She said, did they find out why the Virginia Tech shooter's known psychological problems weren't sent to the background check system?
I don't know exactly why. I know at that point in time, Virginia had actually one of the highest rates, highest percentages of medical records already in the system, close to, you know, over 50. Some states had less than 10. And now there was an effort. The NICS Improvement Act was one of the legislation that immediately passed, which basically threw more money at the problem and gave states more money to submit all those records. Some states have made improvements, others haven't. Something we need to fix as well.
Have enforcement and compliance been improved any since then? Do you think that if another person with a similar situation, somebody everybody knows is troubled, goes out to buy a gun, that there's a good chance that they won't run a background check on him?
I'd hope not. I mean, it's on the responsibility of the individual sellers themselves. You know,
is that where we should be putting that responsibility?
Well, you know, as any reasonable, responsible American, I think you would want to know that the person you're about to sell your gun to is legally allowed to obtain it. I think that's a fair thing to say.
Another listener asks, are you campaigning for specific legislation now?
Our main legislative priority is to close the gun show loophole that would require private sellers at gun shows to conduct background checks, just like all the dealers are doing right next to them.
Let's take a call. Pete from Long Island, how are you on the air?
Oh, yeah, good afternoon. I'm listening to Mr. Goddard. We've met briefly and spoken in the past. A couple minutes ago, you mentioned people buying a gun in Georgia and bringing it into New York and selling it on the street. Well, that's already a crime. That is a federal felony, but it's not being prosecuted.
Well, the mayor complains that since it's so easy to buy a gun in Georgia, he would like to see changes made in the way Georgia people sell guns in Georgia. I'm just picking on Georgia. There are many states.
That's just fine, but Georgia has to follow the same federal guidelines as New York does as far as firearms purchases do.
So why are all these guns coming in here?
The gun is purchased. When it's brought into New York, if we're talking about a handgun, it's illegal to bring a handgun to New York without going through a federal firearms licensee to start with.
You know, it's illegal to traffic in cocaine, but if there were a couple of states that were allowing for cocaine to be sold, wouldn't you assume that some of that would be moved across state lines to states where it was not
criminals.
Legal?
And the criminals don't follow the rules to start with. That's why they're criminals.
So what is your answer,
criminals,
Pete?
Criminals don't follow the laws.
Pete, what is your answer? Just we're going to arrest all these people who are coming from Georgia to New York with guns?
If they're committing a crime, they should be prosecuted.
Okay.
Many, many crimes occur, and federal laws are not enforced.
Isn't part of the problem, Colin, that you can't even tell where a gun was sold?
Right. Private sales have no paper trail. You're right. So it's very difficult to determine.
So whether this is legal or illegal, it would be almost impossible to figure it out.
Under the current system, yes. If we actually had private sellers conducting background checks and having a record of that, which is also destroyed in 24 hours, but at least at that point of sale, you have an intervention. You know, unfortunately, we should also focus on the opposite end, the prosecution side. Absolutely, I agree with the caller. But we should also do more. beforehand, not just after the fact that he's already done something. We need to make it harder before to do that to begin with. And by doing that is by running a simple background check.
Lon from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air. Is it Lon or Lou? Lou. Go ahead, Lon.
Yeah, good afternoon. Yeah, it's a very powerful subject. My brother was shot to death many years ago with an illegal gun. And I believe there should be a broad ban on guns. I don't believe that law-abiding citizens should have access to guns unless they're, you know, in your home. I think if someone tries to breach your home, I think a law-abiding citizen should have an opportunity to defend themselves in their home. But I don't think that anyone in this country should have access to a gun outside their home. Just because you're a law-abiding citizen, that doesn't mean that you can't, you know, a background check is not a a fail-proof method of determining who should have guns in this country. Okay, we have a broad-based ban on guns except for in your home. That pretty much will solve the problem right there.
Now, I want to ask another question along these lines. There are other countries that have much stricter gun control laws, in Europe especially. In many of those countries, people can go hunting, but they have to keep their guns, their rifles, in some specific place and then go get them taken out for them.
Your hunter, sure.
And the murder rates in those countries are much lower than they are in the United States.
Right. I'd say there's
Lesson here?
I'd say that's a direct correlation right there, absolutely.
When was your brother killed, Lou?
This was back in 1980.
Mm, a long time ago.
Shot to death. Yeah, a long time ago. But the fact is, a 19-year-old kid. I was 19, 18-year-old kid, and you know, life snuffed out, you know, before he even really got a chance to reach his full potential in society, you know, because of gun violence. Now the person that shot him, you know, they did some time, but you know, that doesn't bring my brother back. And you know, the gentleman who was shot at Virginia Tech, you know, my sympathy goes out to you know, to all the people who died and yourself, the people who were injured. You know, I mean, that was a devastating event. But law-abiding citizens go out and shoot people every day.
Well, in the case of the Virginia Tech shooter, he did something that we often see in these kinds of instances. This is partly a suicidal act. They shoot a lot of people, then they kill themselves.
Right. I believe he was ready to take out as many people as he could beforehand, before he was ready to go himself.
Thanks for calling us, Lou. We go now to Phil from Rockland County. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm enjoying this segment very much. I am on the other side of the issue from your guest, but I like the way he's presenting it with, you know, a lot of reasonableness that I don't often hear. I'm a licensed New York State gun owner. And I guess my problem with increased regulation is the police don't prevent gun violence, and they can only respond to an incident, whereas a private citizen who is armed has, I think, a much better chance of being able to respond and save themselves. Now, I mean, in New York, there is training involved, and I think those of us who consider ourselves to be irresponsible gun owners, we practice. We don't just, you know, think that we know how to use it. We take it very seriously. Going armed is a decision that is, it took me quite a while to discover that that's what I wanted to do. But, you know, I think it's a great responsibility, and it's one that I embrace and take very seriously.
Now, Phil, do we know how many people actually have defended themselves with guns under circumstances where they've been threatened?
I couldn't speak to that. I don't know.
I suspect it's very few. I mean, a lot of people who say, I have a gun to protect myself, I suspect that there are only a few instances we usually read about them where a store owner has a gun underneath the counter and protects himself when somebody is aiming a gun at him. But it's not all that common,
except
in theory.
Well, I don't know how come. As I said, I can't speak to that. What I can say is if you don't have a gun, you have zero chance protecting yourself. I honestly, I wish I knew more statistics as to who protects themselves and why. I suspect that there are instances where a person has produced a weapon and an attacker has fled and nothing has been told to the police or anyone else. But again, that's just suspicion on my part.
So is gun education a major part of the solution, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. I view a gun as a responsibility and a tool and something that I don't think everyone should own a gun by any means. And I think those who do should be educated. But I think people should just be educated as to what they are and what they aren't and, make the decision for themselves.
I suspect you pretty much agree with him.
I absolutely agree with the caller. I think it's a huge responsibility. He has a right to do to carry as he does, and he's making that choice, and that's, I have no problem with that at all. It's just, and I'm actually with New York's permit system. With the training required, I think is a good thing. Unfortunately, in Virginia, if you'd like your concealed carry license, one of the things you can do to get it is go online, visit a website, watch a video for 1 hour, take a 20-question quiz, mail your responses into your clerk of district court, and they'll mail you your permit, and that's it.
I wish it was that easy to get a driver's license.
Right. It's not quite the same thing.
Your father appears in the documentary film with you. Has he become an advocate as well?
Yeah, he actually did before I did. He became involved and affiliated with the Million Mile March, and he was the one who opened my eyes to this world that I knew nothing about before. So this is actually somewhat of a father-son activity. And I'm on conference calls with my father, and it's great. We get to bounce ideas back and forth. And we actually recently just started a blog together on Huffington Post and the Brady Campaign website, Goddard's on Guns. And hopefully we'll be putting some good commentary into the debate, because it needs to be, a reasonable debate here. Both sides on the extremes can't maintain this conversation. It's going nowhere. We need to have some reasonable compromise in the middle.
Well, where can we see this film?
Well, you can check out the trailer at livingfor32.com. That's 32, the numbers. We were taking a national tour with the film and showing it to universities and major cities and places around the country. If you'd like to have it shown in your area, I'd say contact us through the website. And also on that website, you can find out if it will be in an area near you.
And meanwhile, we had Colin Goddard here to talk about it. He is a survivor of the Virginia Tech shooting. Three bullets still in your shoulder?
Actually, in my hips and above my knee. The one in my shoulder was the one that exited.
Thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a real pleasure talking with you.
Thank you for having me.